You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon. It's Paula Lozon Ostman. Commander Garcia is not going to be with us today as he's out flying to Madrid. Current conditions here in Boston are 68 and partly sunny. In the news today from the Hill, former Senator John Edwards, a Democrat from North Carolina, has been indicted and will plead not guilty to 6 federal charges related to alleged campaign finance law violations. The indictment charges Edwards with 1 count of conspiracy for violating federal campaign finance laws and making false statements to the FEC. 4 counts of accepting and receiving illegal campaign contributions from 2 donors in 2007 and 2008, and 1 count of concealing those illegal donations from the FEC, which is the Federal Election Commission, according to the Justice Department. The charges come after a 2-year investigation, and they arise from hundreds of thousands of dollars 2 prominent campaign donors gave to videographer Rielle Hunter after it was reported that she and Edwards had an affair. It has since been revealed that Edwards fathered a child with her. If convicted, Edwards faces a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine on the conspiracy charge. He faces 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine on each count of accepting and receiving illegal campaign contributions, and a maximum of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine on the charge of concealing the alleged illegal donations, according to DOJ. From the New York Times, the average unemployed person in America has been looking for work for 39.7 weeks, or more than 9 months. That is the longest average unemployment spell since the Labor Department started keeping track in 1948. The growing length of joblessness is particularly worrisome because it tends to be self-perpetuating. The longer a person is unemployed, the less employable they become because of factors like stigma and skill deterioration. That means that the longer it takes to get Americans back to work, the further behind they'll fall. To add insult to injury, many unemployed people who have retrained for new careers have so far racked up student loan debts but no jobs. These long-term unemployed are disproportionately composed of older workers, who, compared to younger workers, are less likely to lose their jobs but more likely to have trouble finding reemployment if they are laid off. Given how far behind these workers have already fallen, it may turn out that many of these Americans will never work again. Now, this afternoon, we're going to have a special rebroadcast of yesterday's incredible interview with Lori Farouzendehan, who is an award-winning author of Lori's Song, which is the story of an American woman held captive in Iran. Take a listen and enjoy.
You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network. You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. You're listening to the American Hour on the USA Talk Radio Network. And, of course, my lovely co-host, Paula Lozon Ostman, is with us today from Boston. How are you, Paula?
Doing great. Current conditions here in Boston are 72 and partly sunny and breezy.
Oh. Of course, you had a few tornadoes yesterday, huh?
Yeah, unexpected. Out from Springfield to Westfield, or I should say reverse, from Westfield to Springfield, that traveled from west to east.
Wow.
Something that doesn't occur here. Nothing like what occurs in Tornado Alley. Unfortunately, four people perished. One, they feel, was not tornado-related, but, you know, it wasn't anything that they were expecting, and I'm not downgrading what had occurred. A state of emergency was issued last night by the governor, and everybody's coming together to help the people out in the communities. Apparently, you know, most of the news says that only two weather watchers are saying seven across the pike.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Now, how often do you get tornadoes in the Boston or Massachusetts area?
Not often at all. From what I gather from the news that I've been hearing and reading, 50 years was probably the last one or ones that had occurred. It's not something that happens. But the Worcester-Springfield area being the way it is, hilly, and the way the weather was coming through, it sparked something. So,
yeah.
And it was not expected. I mean, if you go on to, you know, YouTube or bostonchannel.com, there were people that have posted videos that watched the through that the traffic in the city was just moving along as normal. Nobody realized what was going on.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about this earlier, but La Nina is the cause for all these tornadoes. Tornadoes are not caused by hot weather. In fact, as we get into the summer and it gets warmer up in Canada, we'll see these tornadoes go away. But we get some cool air coming down from Canada, and that's because of a change in the water patterns out in the equatorial Pacific. You've got cooler water now, and they call it La Nina. When it's El Nino, then it's warmer waters. But La Nina causes cooler waters, and that changes the flow patterns and tends to draw more cool air down from Canada. Now, as Canada gets warmer, but see, here's what happened. You had a little bit of a front go through the other day, and then Nancy just came back a couple days ago from Canada, and she said it was hot up there, you know, in the mid-high 80s, and then all of a sudden, when that front came through, then cool air. So you've got cool air now coming along towards the northeast where it is warm, and I think a few days ago you had told me that it was nice and warm there. Cool air, warm air mixing, the center of a tornado, the storm center, is a cool air mass. So that's what it takes. As we see, as we get into the summertime, that'll all go away. But it's not an odd phenomenon. It's odd in that, you know, it only occurs, these kind of tornadoes at these rates occur when we have a strong La Nina. And in fact, not to minimize any of the bad tornadoes that have hit the Midwest, but none of them rise to the level of the top 25 in the last 60 years. So this is not anything odd whatsoever. We can go back in time and find much stronger tornadoes, you know, 60 years over the last 60 years. So this is not the worst we've ever seen, actually. And a lot more people have died in the past than are dying in current tornadoes. And again, not to minimize anything, it's just the facts. And that's how weather operates. And we've seen much worse weather in other times. Of course, for the most part, recorded history on weather and more accurate recorded weather is really in just the last, you know, maybe 100 years at the most. So, but that's kind of what's been going on. All right. Well, we've got a great guest coming on today. But before we get into our guest, let me just go into who our guest is going to be. If you looked at the description on the website or what I put out on Twitter today at The American Hour, if you're on Twitter, follow us on The American Hour. On Facebook, go to The American Hour Radio Show, please, and click on that like button. But I post the stuff on all of those as well as the website, which is located at usaradionetwork.com. And we've got some other great hosts there as well, and I'll talk about a few of those in a few minutes. But we've got, let me just read it here, what I've typed up today. What goes on in Iran, and is it a threat? Lori Forozanda, and we'll get her to pronounce her name for us, author of Lori's Song, The Story of an American Woman Held Captive in Iran. Now, it's not just about being held captive in Iran, but it's really about the culture there, and she'll make the point, but I want to make this point, and she does in her book, that wonderful people, wonderful culture there, but there's some political issues going on and an oppressive government. And so she was treated very, very poorly right after 9/11. And she sort of surmises that the government wanted to have some leverage. Hey, we've got a bunch of Americans in prison. Don't come over and attack us. And now the question is, well, wait a minute. Iran wasn't involved in 9/11. Apparently they were so afraid of the retaliation that would come that we might just decide to pick on them as well. Now, who do we go after? The Taliban, in Afghanistan. Well, what was Iran doing to help out the Taliban? So they clearly had some reason to be afraid. And this just goes to show what a dangerous, dangerous state this is. They knew that we might be coming for them. Now, we didn't. I'm thinking maybe we should have anyway, but we didn't. So, but they grabbed a bunch of American hostages. Now, when you're there and you're a dual citizen, they treat you like you're Iranian. But the instant they need something from you, now you're suddenly an American, and they're going to treat you very poorly. So we're going to get her story and find out just what went on there. But as I was saying, the website, if you go to usaradionetwork.com, the first thing you're going to do when you go to the American Hour page, you're going to see it says the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia and Paula Lausanne Osman, Monday through Friday, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern. That's going to change. It's summertime. We've decided we're going to work about as hard as our legislators, so we're only going to work 2 days a week. From now on, it's going to – or not from now on, but for the summer, it's going to be Monday and Wednesday, and it's going to be at 4 p.m. Eastern, starting at 4 p.m. Well, in any case, we'll come back to that later on, but we've got our guest on board, and thank you for joining us today, Lori. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. I don't think we've ever actually spoken on the phone, have we?
No, we haven't.
No. Wow. Well, this is a pleasure. We've been conversing about having you on the show for quite some time, and I just wanted to let you know that I found on Facebook a group called, and I don't know if you checked them out. You might even be a member because there's 12,767 people that like this, but it's Women of the World United Against Islamic Muslim Sharia Law. Have
yes,
you seen that page?
That.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Because I posted today some information about the show, and there's a couple people already like, hey, we like this. This is good. And so what I do is I'll go back and post it again after the show is over to let people know, hey, you might have missed the show, but you can always come download it. And that's the great thing about this Internet Talk Radio is people can stream this again after the fact and download it at any time onto their smartphone, their iPod, et cetera. Of course, what they don't have is the ability to call in. And if anybody's out there listening and you do want to call in, please, the number is 310-982-4145. Now, I gave you a little bit of an introduction, and we'll get to that. I'll let you reintroduce yourself and make sure that you, you know, tell people exactly what you want them to know about you. But how can people connect with you? I've got your webpage up right now, which is lorissong.com, and it's spelled lorissong.com. Is there anywhere else people can connect with you and find out more about your book and your story?
Sure. I've got an email. It's lori@lorissong.com, which is lorissong.com.
Okay.
And I've also, for people who are interested in interviews, I just did another press release with my phone number on it.
Okay.
I guess I could give it out because it's on the Internet anyway. 517-522-8765. And basically, you know, I belong to a lot of organizations. And if you Google me, if you can spell my last name or remember it, it's Forzande, you'll see quite a few sites that I belong to.
Okay. Now, yeah, I totally butchered your last name, and one of the things I said at the beginning of the show is we're going to have to ask you to say your last name, Forzande.
Yeah, you got it
right. See, I'm just mimicking you like a parrot, you know, that's all I'm doing, but I wouldn't have said it that way by reading it. But if they do a search for Lorissong, I'm sure that's going to come up.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's the easiest one. So Lorissong. And then your book is available, and I'm looking at your webpage, and it looks really convenient. It's right there on Amazon. People can buy it. Is there anywhere else that they can get it besides Amazon?
It's available everywhere. It's available at your local bookstore. They might have to order it. But
okay.
Ingram's doing the publishing, or not publishing, but they put out the books. So,
yeah.
So does Baker and Taylor.
Okay. Well, to me, I tell you what, buying from Amazon, I'm just too busy a person to, you know, if I happen to be by a bookstore, but I don't have time to go to a bookstore, I love being able to just go on Amazon, click on that.
Kindle. Yeah.
Buy it. Yeah, and it shows up a couple of days later, and by the time it shows up, I've already forgotten about it, and it's always a pleasant surprise when a book shows up. So that's great. Okay, we talked about some different you know, things that you wanted to specifically talk about as we emailed back and forth, and I've gone through your story several times and looked over your information and your website, but tell us how you ended up in Iran? How did you end up in Iran to begin with?
Okay. Well, I'm going to be honest here. The facets of my book have a lot in it, but I don't know how much time we got. But what happened was I had a long history of abuse, childhood sexual abuse, and I've had a lot of substance abuse problems. Well, I met Mohammed when I was going to college, and Mohammed was my Iranian husband, and he had always wanted to go over to Iran. So in 1998, we had went there because I was trying to get away from my past and all the problems here. Once we got there, I found out you need your husband's written permission to leave the country.
Oh.
And I did not know that.
Oh, boy.
And I knew Mohammed. We had been married in 1996, but I'd known him since 1993 to 1998, which is when we went over to Iran.
Okay.
And he treated me perfectly over here.
Hmm.
And then when we got to Iran, he totally changed. At the risk, I'm not going to go into this, but he did, if you read the book, he did turn out to be a state-sponsored terrorist, okay, belief-wise.
Now, do you think that he was involved in that stuff in any way when he was in the U.S., or he got there and he got recruited in Iran?
No, he was involved here because he used to ship cars over there. He used to make several trips back and forth to Iran with drugs.
Oh.
And
I see.
Yeah, he used to, I mean, I didn't really know it until we got over there and he was telling me these things because he shot somebody in front of me and I was like, okay, what's going on now? And he would execute Iranian war vets so the government wouldn't have to deal with them and their disability.
Oh, boy.
I met President Khatami. I mean, I know he was involved in a lot more over there.
Yeah.
And there's another guy, Mohammed Forzandi, with the same name. And I think they double for each other. There's always a double for a government person over there. So if anybody tries to execute him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. But, so we went over there and we found that out. And he turned into a different person. And then 911 happened. We had an immigration consulting business where he would get people false visas over here, too.
Okay.
And, okay, we had a lot of information about, we knew something was going to happen in America on 911. We didn't know where or what, but for sure we knew it was going to happen.
Oh, boy.
I tried to call home on the 9th, 10th, and 11th, and the operator said no international calls being placed at this time. So
wow.
I thought that was kind of odd. But the day after 9/11, my husband told me we have to get out of Iran. And I didn't know why. He said it was in case the U.S. retaliated against the Middle East for what happened. So
yeah.
We went to the Shiraz.
Well, let me ask you about this. I read that, and you said that in case the Middle East or the U.S. retaliates against the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, did people think that the U.S. would come over and just start blowing up every country in the Middle East, or selectively attack countries that they felt were involved? Because when I read that, all of a sudden I got to thinking, Iran must be guilty. The only time you're worried about being attacked, really, is if you're guilty of something. And Iran must have sort of thought it was guilty of something in some way of aiding and abetting the Taliban in Afghanistan. So, but what's your take on that?
I'm sure they did. They used to have a limo where Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, they would ride around in the same car, and you had an Iraqi flag on the front and an Afghanistan flag on the back.
Oh, wow.
And people would point that out, you don't go near that car, and when it comes through, it always had, like a parade.
Wow.
But, yeah,
so for all those people out there that say Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and terrorism, well, apparently they were wrong.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean,
yeah.
I lived through this. My book is totally true. The embassy knows it, and that's another story. When I was in the camp, I was in for 6 weeks. They picked us up at the bus station when we showed our passports.
So you were trying to get out of the country, right, as a U.S. citizen? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this is after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'm just trying to make it clear for everybody. After 9/11, and they grabbed you because they had a sense, you said it earlier, but then I kind of cut you off a little bit, you had a sense, or they felt like, we need basically some hostages to use as leverage in case the U.S. decides to come attack us.
Exactly.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
All right.
And as soon as we showed our American passports at the bus station, because we were going to get a bus to Istanbul and then fly out of there, they picked us up about 5 minutes later. These two trucks showed up, and they blindfolded us, and I'm still kind of, I'm sorry, emotional over this. They blindfolded us, and they took me in one truck and took my husband in another, and I never saw him again.
But now, do you have any idea what happened to him?
Oh, yeah. That's another story. He's over here now.
Well, he's in the U.S. now.
Yeah. That's another thing.
Is he on any kind of terror watch list or anything like that?
Yes. He was supposed to be on a no-fly list back in 2001. They put him on it, and I don't know why, but February 2010, I got a call that he was in the jail up in Marquette, Michigan, and that they could only hold him 90 days for a past drug charge. Now, I thought that was kind of odd. I think that he agreed to tell him things, and that's how he got out. But
Now he's living in the U.S.?
Yeah, and I'm dealing with Homeland Security. I'm trying to get him out of here.
You know, this is what I understand about our system. My thought would be, you're going to stay in jail and rot in jail forever, or you can tell us stuff, and then when you're done telling us, we'll deport you. But look at how soft our government system is. It says, oh, we really want to know information. Okay, it sounds like he had the bargaining chip. Yeah, I get to stay here in the U.S. if I tell you. Okay, wow.
Exactly.
I mean, I can't speak because I wasn't there, but we'll get I'm going to contact Michael Cutler on this. You may or not have seen the show we did about a week or so ago. He's a 30-year INS agent. I'm going to ask him about this specifically, why we would do this. And, of course, there's always circumstances and things that you're not sure about, and maybe they're using him. Maybe they're using him on an ongoing effort. But I think it's despicable that we allow a guy that was involved in that kind of activity to stay in this country. And, you know, we're finding out now that, like over in Libya, for example, some of the detainees that we released from Guantanamo Bay, guess who they're fighting with? The rebels. So we're over there helping these rebels that have people that were, you know, arrested in Guantanamo Bay, and we finally released them because we felt like, well, you know, there's not that we made a mistake. It's just there's nothing we can do at this point, and we feel that they're not going to, you know, do anything harmful to the U.S. What happens when they take control of Libya, if they do at some point? We got former Guantanamo Bay detainees that are now involved in the hierarchy in Libya. It just can't be good for the U.S. So I see a lot of weakness in our security system. I'm not impressed. This is not impressing me at all.
No, there's, I mean, at the end of the story, I mean, I could tell you what happened in the camp. I mean, it was just literally torture, rapes, and everything. And my teeth were all knocked out, and I came home weighing 70 pounds, and I had traumatic brain injuries. But we were there 6 weeks. I was handcuffed to a girl, and her mom and dad watched her get publicly raped in this camp. So somehow her brother got a guard to let us out. And there were two Pakistani guys there waiting for us on the other side of the fence. And I know they'd done this before because they were leading us back over the hills back into Shiraz. And they would stop at certain trees and dig up water and food. And they let us, I think it was, I said it was a llama. Everybody said I was crazy because I was, you know, emaciated. They said it was a camel. And we rode for 2 nights back into Shiraz. When I got to Shiraz, I went to Ostaderi, which is a place for foreigners in need in Iran, because there is no USA embassy. And they flew me to Dubai after 2 weeks. And they flew me to Dubai, and the Sheikh of Dubai, his name was Mohammed too, put me up in the American hospital to get me internal stitches for a sexual assault. And our embassy made me actually sit at the airport for 2 nights, and that's when the Sheikh got mad and said, this is ridiculous. And then the embassy, when they finally did sign, you know, to get pay my way home, they made me sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Guess what? Screw them.
What happened.
Disclose all you want.
Yeah, exactly. But
jeez,
it was crazy. But, you know, what my husband was involved in, you know, and I know I must sound like I'm rambling, but I'm not sure how much time we have and stuff.
Oh, we got plenty of time. You take your time, sweetheart. You just tell us what you want to tell us. So my impression is this. Let's back up a little bit because some bad things happened, and we know after 9/11 this was not so good. Pre-9/11, how was it living in Iran?
They told me it was, you know, what do you call it, modern. When I got over there, the first thing I saw was death to America graffiti on the buildings and stuff. And I saw this guy smack this girl in the face because apparently she wasn't following, you know, whatever it is, 5 feet behind him or a feet behind him.
Okay.
And the husbands do that. I know there's honor killings because, well, other killings too. But when I got there the first couple weeks, there was a lady that got hung in Tehran Square by a construction crane. And they hang them very slowly. They don't, you know, it's not a quick hanging. And they let them dangle there for like 20 minutes, and they let everybody watch, including the kids.
Jeez. Nice culture. Boy, I have to say this. Now, I've known some Iranians over the years, and this would be dating back way pre-9/11. When I was first in the Navy, actually even waiting to go to flight school out in San Diego, so I was just waiting for a slot to open up, and I was working out at Miramar Naval Air Station in a squadron that several years later, I was actually an instructor in, but initially I was just a kind of a gopher waiting to go to flight school, but I got to fly with them in the backseat of a TA-4. But we had some neighbors that were from Iran. And the one gentleman had a couple wives. The other had one wife and had some kids. And they were very nice. I mean, they were very nice.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of nice Iranians.
And I'm sure there are, and that's not to say that, well, I have some friends that are Iranian and they're nice people, but you know, they really seem to be very nice, and it sort of gives me the impression that, you know, they weren't wealthy or anything like that. I mean, this was when I first got commissioned in the Navy, and so I didn't have much money, and I'm living in an apartment, and they lived in the same apartment complex, not a bad apartment complex, but not, you know, certainly nothing fancy, and they drove an older car. I actually helped them work on their car once because they had some trouble with the engine, and I had restored a Firebird, and I had a Camaro, and I was always tinkering on those things and working. So they figured I knew something about cars. So I came over and I helped them out with it. And, you know, they didn't have it certainly wasn't a fancy car, and it may have even been that the two families even shared that one car. I can't remember at this point. But my impression was and is to this day, they left Iran because they didn't want to live there. And,
the
kind of people that are nice like that are the kind of people that don't want to stay there because of the political system and the theocratic system that's going on there.
I would say about 80% of the people over there don't want to be there. There's so many people applying to get student visas for their children. There's so many people willing to pay people off to get a visa. I mean, my husband supposedly was related to the Shah. That's what he said. We lived on the same street as the Shah's palace was, but we lived well. We lived very well. Okay. And it's like when we were over there, I taught English at Shiraz University School, Zaban Amazon. And it was a school for, you know, I taught anywhere from 12-year-olds all the way up to 20-year-olds. One of my students was drowned in her father's swimming pool for not being a virgin on her wedding night. And that's when I quit teaching.
Yeah.
This is the kind of, but there's so many nice Iranians, and I don't want to make this, you know, a hate Iranian or hate Muslim book, because the only thing wrong with Muslims are the fanatics, the ones who take it too far and the Quran out of context. But there are many, many good people that are Iranians. But I'm sorry, on the percentage-wise, there's a lot of fanatics, too.
Yeah. Well, try and paint a picture for us. If you could envision a more, and I hate to say democratic, I don't know what kind of, you know, structure the vast majority of American or of Iranian people would like to live under there. Maybe they would like some form of a democracy, you know, some kind of system like either Great Britain has, the Canadians, Australia, or even the U.S. So let's just say they come up with some more Western political type of system. What would you envision the country of Iran looking like in terms of, you know, an outsider not knowing anything about it, but the people and the potential for a place to come visit and that sort of thing? I don't even know what the countryside looks like. You know, a lot of people's impression
that
it's just a big, vast desert. I mean, what could it look like, do you envision?
First of all, I never see it being democratized, so to speak.
Okay.
I mean, it's just the people are too afraid of the government. And as far as countryside, it's beautiful. I mean, it's not all sand and desert, and it's beautiful to visit as far as tourists, but you should never go over there because you don't know the laws. This goes for any country, but especially Iran, because they will lie or do anything just to get an American in the prison. There's a famous prison over there, and they will do anything. They don't like Americans on the whole. because they know what we have. They're jealous of it.
Okay.
And it's very, I mean, you have, there's a curfew at night. You have to be in by 11 o'clock. They have this saving electricity thing where, you know, your lights on your side of the street are out for one night, and then they, you know, go back and forth. It's just, you know, to walk around there, everybody has to have their head covered, and they got to be in, like, this thing called a rosary, which is sort of like a long blazer. And then some of the fanatic families have to wear those big black chadors. And if you let anything be exposed, then your husband can beat you in public, and they won't do anything about it. It's not like you here you can call the police.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They would laugh at you over there. But
well, now, what do you see going on in the U.S. now? We know that we've got some sort of enclaves, some areas within the U.S. where Muslims have kind of grouped together and formed communities. That's not unheard of at all. We've got all kinds of enclaves like that. You can find here in South Florida neighborhoods and areas that are predominantly Haitian or Latin, Cuban, Puerto Rican, and then, you know, you go all the way through the country. You can find predominantly Irish. Is that possible in the Boston area, Paula?
It is.
Yeah, I've seen a few of those areas in Boston, but
yeah.
and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just kind of the way things go. You know, people kind of congregate. The town that my wife was born in up in Canada was almost all German. You know, a lot of German immigrants came in there, and there's huge German influence. We went to an Oktoberfest parade one year that was a blast. It was in October, and it was snowing, of course, lightly, but it was snowing and cold, and so that kind of thing happens. But do you see areas in this country that start to kind of grow and become predominantly maybe of the Muslim influence wanting to bring Sharia law into their community?
Oh, sure. I went to a couple conferences thinking they were trying to liberate Muslims, and instead they were doing – it's such a brainwashing thing that because they had me brainwashed over there that Muslim was the only religion – and that if women got hung for adultery, they almost deserved it. I mean, that's how much my mind that they screwed with. And these people have a way of getting to you and manipulating you into thinking that their way is correct.
Yeah.
And if you're a very vulnerable person or insecure, you're going to go along with them. Because
yeah.
I know they do it in Dearborn. I mean, I know a few people who are in charge of the sessions up there. They do it there, but I mean, I know there's a lot of places, San Diego. I belong to the Iran Politics Club, and they were the first one that published my book. They're out of San Diego, and they're totally against, you know, the regime in Iran. But
yeah.
As far as Iran goes, there's no enclave of Americans. I think I met 6 Americans there.
Wow.
The whole
yeah.
time, you know, and it's, you don't go, my husband had to go around and speak to different people, like conferences. And he didn't want me to know Farsi, which is the language.
Okay.
I knew it, but I didn't know it, you know, very well. And I wasn't allowed to go with him, or if I did, I couldn't ask questions or, you know, it's just so, oh, I can't explain it. It's so, I don't know, instructional. Because if
yeah.
you're an American over there, you're at their mercy. And they basically
yeah. Yeah.
tell you exactly how to act.
Well, this is my take on, I've read about 3 different books on Islam and Muhammad, and we all know that books can be very jaded, and I was very careful at which books I chose. But one of the things that stood out to me is, you know, when Muhammad announced that they could violate treaties that they had created with other cities, groups of people, etc., because the angel Gabriel had told him from, you know, coming from God. That was his messenger to God. He never spoke directly with God, but it was the angel Gabriel that would come and speak with him. And, of course, you probably know more about this than me, but just so correct me if I'm wrong. But told him, no, you can violate treaties if you suspect that your so-called enemies that you have treaties with are maybe not going to live up to it. So it didn't mean that they had violated any way or in the process of. You just suspect. In other words, you're free to basically violate any treaty you want as long as this is a treaty with infidels. So to me, that spills over into the culture as if you're an infidel, there's no hold barred. We can lie to you, treat you like crap, and not treat you the way we would treat another Muslim. And so that's what you were, as you were saying earlier, you know, that lie and, you know, that be deceiving and treat you poorly. I mean, they treat their own people poorly, but if you're an infidel, they have no moral obligation or ethical obligation to deal with you fairly in any way. Am I
You're right there.
Close on that? Yeah. And I think, exactly. To me, I think it goes back to that the vision and the decree that came from, quote, God to Muhammad that, you know what, you don't have to honor these. See, he had made treaties, and he got to the point where he didn't want to honor those treaties anymore. That's really the bottom line. And mm-hmm. So he decided, if God were to tell me, well, if you're concerned about this this enemy, you don't have to live up to the treaty. You know, in the Christian religion, as well as other religions, and in the Western world, if you have a contract with somebody, you're not free to break that contract if you suspect they may not be living up to it. You have to live up to it until they violate it, and then you're no longer bound by it. But this is a whole different concept, and so I think that whole concept in the Muslim culture and teaching has spilled into their daily lives, and that's why they treat Westerners so much differently than Westerners would treat, you know, anybody else from a different culture. We treat them with a different level of respect. Now, that's not to say that all Muslims do that, but when you find the ones that just are being really bad and extreme, et cetera, I think that's where it originates, and I may be wrong about that. I'm not any expert on it. But that's what I gathered from reading the three different books. That kind of stood out to me.
Well, Islam has the five pillars of faith. And basically the five pillars of faith are what they practice. Any Christian or Catholic would practice it too. It just involves believing in one God, praying, giving to charities, fasting during certain times, and then making the trip to Mecca. And if they say that, you know, they believe Allah is a whole separate God. They don't believe in our God at all, but they do honor Jesus as being a prophet. Not a prophet, as a person.
Right.
But not as a prophet. But they do acknowledge him and Mary.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that Christ had already come and gone, and, you know, we obviously then already had the Jewish religion, and Muhammad had said neither the Old Testament or New Testament are incorrect. It's just that the Christians and the Jews don't understand them and aren't following the law of God properly.
Exactly.
Something to that effect. And so he never was willing to, you know, deny. And I think part of that might have been to try and recruit Jews and Christians. And at the same, you know, at the same time, in a subtle way, say, you know, never argue with those books. Because I think a lot of the basis for the Muslim religion was what religion was already out there. You didn't want to offend all of these people, but at the same time, you can basically say that, well, you all got it wrong, and I know what's right. And so, you know, it's kind of an interesting take on other religions. But in any case, let me ask you about the book again. So if anybody's just tuned in, it's called Lori's Song.
I just have to tell you one thing. Now that we're talking about God, when I was in that camp, we couldn't talk. We were, you know, outside for 6 weeks, and we were watered down with a hose every other day. But I was chained to this girl, Faresh, from Bahrain. And the night before we were escaping, getting ready to escape, and I had no idea we were going to escape the next night, somebody tapped me on my shoulder, and I turned around, and nobody was there. And somebody said, Lori, you're going home. And I know that was God talking to me. Because nobody was allowed to talk in that camp.
Yeah, interesting. That's very interesting. Well, you know, there are a lot of people in very difficult situations that have stories like that. And and you know what, there's a common thread among people that are in very stressful situations or life-threatening situations, and that is their faith in God. And they either have a feeling come over them, a strong feeling, or they hear a voice like that. And you don't even, you never find an atheist that will say, yeah, I was in a very stressful situation, and I heard a voice saying, don't worry, there is no God, but you'll be okay. I mean,
yeah.
Nobody ever hears that. So,
yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. That's great. That's a great story. And the book, I went on to Amazon.com, and for the most part, almost everybody that's read it gave it a five-star rating. I mean, there was just five-star after five-star after five-star. So people really liked the book, and it sounds like a very compelling story. And
oh,
again,
it won an award.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It won an award, Reader's Favorite Award.
Oh, awesome.
It
well,
has the seal on the book. It should have. But I just have problems getting – I still have yet to do an interview on TV. And then the reason I released the press release like 3 months ago is I've been in therapy, of course, and we finally decided that I was ready for a TV interview, you know, because I have my PTSD and some other issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of this book is politically controversial, and I think that's why I can't get people to do the actual interview.
Yeah.
I don't know for sure, but...
Well, if I were on TV, I'd definitely do the interview, but we're going to have you back for sure because what we're going to do is we're going to promote this interview. People can listen to it, and basically the way I'm going to promote this in the future is you missed a great interview, so we're going to have Lori back because we want as many people as possible. You know, regardless of how many people are listening today and download it, that's how we're going to promote it, so we can just really double up on the folks out there. And I will also send out a press release to a lot of the conservative groups that I know. This is a conservative political show, and the reality is what you're talking about has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with an extreme nation that is a threat to the world, really, literally, and also a culture that can be dangerous in the wrong hands, and we need to be aware of that. We need to be aware of the cultural differences. And from somebody's perspective like yourself that was there and to see how you got treated and to see how women continue to get treated, even in our own country, by some of these fanatics, people need to be aware of that. So send me your press release, Lori, and I'll utilize that to put out my own press release and get more information out. We'll put a link on the website as well. I've been slow to put links on there. I've been telling people about doing that, but I'll get that done in the next few days, by next week. But send me your press release so that I can include that. And
proceeds of the book go to charity, too. The only money I want to raise for myself is to pay for my dental bill to replace the teeth that were knocked out in the camp.
Yeah, okay.
But donating all proceeds to charity.
Okay, well, that's wonderful. I mean, I don't even know what to say. I think there is a link on here about, let's see, I'm trying to look for where the donation link is on your webpage. I see something that says info and donations, but I see, like, see, you're promoting all kinds of other great things like stop violence against women, and but I don't see anywhere where somebody can donate to you.
Well, basically, they get a hold of the radio station, and, you know, if they want to donate it to the dentist that I'm getting my teeth done at, that would be great. I can give them that information because that's all I'm interested in. But if they want to make donations to Amnesty International, that would be great.
Okay. Well, great. So I tell you what, send me your information that you want me to put on the website so that people can not only I mean, I know how to link to your a link to your website, but if somebody wants to make a donation for your dental bill, send me that information, and we'll put that on the website. And, I don't know what to say. It's been a great interview, very compelling. We've got to have you back to talk about this some more, and we'll help promote your book as much as we can. But we really appreciate you coming on, Lori, and it's been a pleasure, and glad we thank you for taking the time to write this book and get the story out and make people aware, and for your ongoing efforts with various women's groups. That's wonderful. So we appreciate that. And Paula, what would you like to say?
I'm just very impressed with how she persevered through the whole thing, and I'm speechless that you had to endure such a thing.
Yeah.
I know that it occurs, but I'm very speechless.
Yeah, that's.
I wish you.
Thank God it's over.
Yep.
And I'm able to share the information so it doesn't happen again.
Yep.
Well, any last words, Paul? Lori, before you have to go.
No, just I appreciate you having me on.
Okay. Well, we'll have you back.
You know, I self-published this book, so I'm trying to get the information out there, you know, or a new publisher or something.
Okay. Well, no, it's compelling. Maybe, I mean, that's what, you know, hopefully is that's another good thing to know. I mean, we didn't know that you self-published.
Okay.
Absolutely. If we could find a better publisher for you, then that certainly would help. I mean, when I say better than you, but, I mean, somebody that's a professional publisher, then there's an opportunity to get, you know, much more dissemination on the book and that sort of thing. So we'll just help promote as much as we can and help get the word out. But and I mean it, we really want to have you back. So we're going to come up with a date here sometime, maybe over the summer, if you're willing to do that. Come back and talk about it some more, and we'll just continue to promote this show and your book so that we can get an even bigger audience, or maybe even some people returning. They get some time to think about it, and maybe they'll ask some questions on the next show. But anyway, Lori, thank you for coming on. Have a great, wonderful weekend, and we look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Right, bye. Wow. So that was impressive. That's, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect, Paula, and she and I have been conversing about coming on the show since back in February. So I'm glad we were able to finally get her on the show. And that's an impressive story. Boy, I mean, I'm kind of speechless, too. I know I don't sound like it, but I'm not really saying much here because I don't know what to say.
I think it's more in the tone in your voice, Tom, that, you know, she and a lot of women, you know, have had and continue to endure that sort of way of life, and they just don't know how to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. Well, sometimes writing a book like that or starting a blog or anything like that can be a outlet and a way of, you know, getting beyond and move beyond. And it sounds like maybe that's what's working here for Lori. So
definitely.
Appreciate that. And when it comes to the PTSD stuff, well, I know a little bit about that because of the work I've done with the homeless vets and the veterans groups that I'm a member of. And that's a tough thing. That makes life hard. Even, you know, if you're not a homeless person. But I've spoken with a woman, this was about 3 years ago, whose husband came back, and, you know, he had a lot of problems. And this guy was an officer in the military and just couldn't get over it. And she finally said, you got to get some help. Got some help, and it really made a difference. But it was very, very difficult there for a while. And at first, she didn't know what it was. So, and we're finding now that PTSD is not just a mental. There actually can be some physical damage to the brain associated with PTSD. So that's something not to be taken lightly. But in any case, we're running out of time for today, but we got a few things now. To cover just a few things. Did you see anything really interesting in the news today, Paula?
You know, there was something that I had come across, and unfortunately it escapes me now, besides what had occurred here yesterday for weather-wise.
Yeah.
I hadn't really seen much except, you know, the talks about the debt ceiling and, you know, what's going on in politics and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
You have to, because I'm still like a little bit on the downside about Lori's story, and I pulled up her website, and it took me into another website called IranPoliticsClub.net. So I plan on reading that stuff and just understanding that a little more in the next couple of days.
And the last thing we'd like to do is say hello to Joan Flowers. Go to the website. Joan Flowers is trying to get her father buried in Arlington Cemetery. He deserves it, and we're working on finding as much information about him. A lot of it was lost in a fire in 1973 in the National Archives, so we don't have a lot of information. But we're working with the American Legion as well as the VFW here in Florida. I have some very good contacts at those levels, at the highest levels, and we're going to see what we can do to get him buried there. But it's not an easy thing, and she spent a lot of her own hard-earned money over the years trying to make this happen, and she's pretty much out of funds. If you can find it in your heart to donate something to her, go to the website and click on my email, which is the American Hour Radio Show at gmail.com. Send me an email and I'll get you connected with her so that you can send her something if you're in the Chicago area. You could even pick something up, some groceries and that kind of thing. She's having a tough time, so please help her out. April 19th was the show that she came on, so you can hear more about what she's been trying to do for her father, a World War II hero, and we'd like to help her out. So, and if you have any voiceover work in the Chicago area, or anywhere. See, voiceover work can be done anywhere. She could sure use the help. So check out the website. There's a link there that talks about Joan Flowers, and you can listen to the show dating back to April 19th. All right, Paul, it's your turn to have the final word.
Well, shout out to our troops serving overseas. We've got another holiday coming up in July, and hopefully many of you will be able to come home and celebrate with your families and your loved ones. We love you and miss you and want you home.
Absolutely. All right, Paula. Well, we'll see you tomorrow. Have a good evening. And thanks for coming on today. And stay away from the tornadoes. Hopefully that won't happen again for another 50 years. And we will see everybody tomorrow, 4 p.m. Thanks for listening in today.
Same to you.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.